You can't solve internal problems with external solutions. And I found that on my own journey. Like, I was struggling mightily inside and I hid that from the entire world. And on the outside looking in, you would have said I was winning, everything was great. And internally, there was a whole lot broken and a whole lot wrong and a whole lot that was more to come that was going to break if I didn't change something. But humans are pretty incredible in their ability to put on a mask and hide things.
What was the moment you're like, no, I want to give myself this chance?
I had a profound realization with very simple math that the amount of time I had left with the people that I cared about most was terrifyingly finite. If you don't create your own definition of success, you will never feel successful.
Today, my guest is Sahil Bloom. He's an investor, an entrepreneur, and a creator. And to me, he is the template of what it means to be a successful entrepreneur in 2025. Here's my chat with Sahil. It takes courage and belief in yourself and your business idea to take the step to set up your own business. In the early stages, entrepreneurship can be a lonely road, even through those milestone moments. Deciding to commit to the idea you've been mulling over, learning, growing, and developing your skills, building a team to help you along the way, preparing to launch into new markets. Enterprise Ireland is there for all of those startup moments. From providing advice and guidance to new founders through our startup network, to pre-seed funding and early investment, we're here to help bring your ambition to fruition. To find out how Enterprise Ireland can help you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of The Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code FOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie, use code FOX20, and elevate your marketing game today. Nostra, an Irish IT company, offers world-class managed IT services, cloud solutions, IT support, and more, all tailored to meet your business needs. Whether you're streamlining operations or boosting productivity, their expert team is ready to help. Visit nostra.ie or email info@nostra.ie to see how they can solve your IT challenges today. Sahil, welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled that we're getting to do this in person.
I was adamant. Yeah. I was going to get you in person. It's such a different experience.
It's much better.
And thank you for being so gracious. Host us here in London.
Yeah.
It's your second home.
It is my second home. I love being here. Although this time of year, it's not quite as nice, but I like being here.
So what is your founder formula for success?
It's a good question. And I know that you always ask that to start these episodes. And I feel like other people have more well thought out versions of this, because it's not something that I think about. Like the word success, and even just like thinking about what is my formula, like I don't feel as though success is some end state that I've achieved. I can tell you what I work on a daily basis. And what I work on is the big picture of my entire life. So my old life, I really focused on financial success as the measure and really focused on building my life around that. Now I focus on several things, and very few of them actually have to do with money. It's really time, people, purpose, and health are the four main things. And for me, when I focus on those things, financial outcomes are actually a natural byproduct of the focus on those. So I don't need to focus on money, because when I'm focusing on my purpose, when I'm grounding myself in those actions, money is a result of it. And I make sure that I'm making time for those other things, for people, and for my health, for the other things that I know allow me to operate at my highest level.
How do you describe yourself?
Very difficult. Probably one of the hardest things, actually, which is a funny thing to say is hard, but one of the hardest things about transitioning my life from where I was to where I am is that I no longer have the sort of easy cocktail party answer when someone asks, what do you do? You know, I used to just say like, oh, I'm an investor, you know, I was vice president at a private equity fund. It's very easy and it sounds nice, good status associated with it. Now I don't really know. I have a book coming out, so I suppose I would say author and entrepreneur maybe. I even hesitate when I say entrepreneur, and I even say it right there with like an intonation to it, because I still don't feel that way. I still feel like sort of an imposter building things. I don't feel like an imposter as a writer, maybe as an author, because I haven't actually published books in the past. This is my first. But as an entrepreneur, I think there's like, in my mind, entrepreneurs are, that word is reserved for people who have like started and sold successful companies. And the reality is that's not true. An entrepreneur can be, you know, someone who starts a local coffee shop, small business, big business, whatever. All of those people are entrepreneurs. It's people who are willing to take that risk and bet on themselves and go and build something. And I have done that. So I should say it proudly, but I would say it still makes me a little uncomfortable.
It's such an interesting observation, because I had an event 2 weeks ago now where I invited back every guest that's been on the pod, and a few of them emailed me and said more or less the same thing. Oh, I feel like an imposter there though, because I know so-and-so is going. And it blew my mind, because like, these are really successful people. Yeah. If you use success that barometer, you know, they've built businesses. To me, any founder is a success if they start, if they go from zero to one. It doesn't matter if you turn over 10,000 or 10 million, you've taken that step, because the biggest killer of businesses is you never start. You stay in that idea of like the when I fallacy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's a few things. I have a few quick reactions. One is that imposter syndrome is a tax on personal progress, meaning it is the cost of entry for achieving personal progress and growth in life. Because by definition, when you are pushing yourself beyond your current competencies and pushing yourself beyond the boundaries of what you can currently do, you are going to be an imposter at whatever that thing is. Jeff Bezos was an imposter at starting an online bookstore before he started Amazon. He was a finance guy. He was an investor. He had never done that before. He was an imposter by definition. But then he went and did it. And so he was no longer an imposter. But just by nature of pushing yourself to grow, you are going to constantly be an imposter. And reframing that in your own mind as actually a positive signal that you're pushing yourself and that you're growing has helped me a lot. Because anytime I catch myself feeling like, oh yeah, I truly fit in all these rooms that I'm going into, I belong here, it's a bad thing. It means I'm not pushing myself to be in rooms that make me uncomfortable. And it's a trade-off, right? It's a balance. Like sometimes you want to remind yourself that you belong. I recently had an experience. I got invited to this event hosted by an author who I've admired for the last 10 years. And it was all of his like handpicked friend, people that he knows and admires. And I went to that the first night, and it was this dinner, and I was so scared. It was like dinner, talking to these people. I really feel like an imposter.
When was this?
Maybe a month ago.
That's interesting, considering your success over the last 3 years. I think it's really refreshing when people like you say that.
Yeah. Because I'm around. It was all people who have like, you know, it's all like number one New York Times bestselling author, 5-time number one New York Times bestselling author, you know, $100 million venture fund, this, you know, entrepreneur sold a company for a lot of money, this person founded, you know, TED, whatever, like the most amazing people. And I was so nervous. I was like, what do I possibly have to say or offer these people? Like they've actually accomplished all of the things in my domain. I'm on the top level. I'm like at the baby level. And I came away from that first dinner, and I went back. I was back in my hotel room, and I texted my wife, and I was like, you know, I had this really nice sensation that I actually belong in that room. I felt like I held my own. Like I could contribute things. I had ideas. I had things that people seemed to care about that they thought were interesting. I had to like cold pitch my book. I just got called up and they were like, pitch your book to the group. And I'd never done that before in front of these people. And I was like, I pitched it, and like people came up to me and they were like, oh wow, we really liked how you said this. And so it was kind of a fun counterpoint to that feeling of imposter syndrome, to have that sensation and actually recognize it and appreciate it in those moments where you do actually recognize that you belong. belonged.
In the moment. At what point did you feel that? At what point of the night did you feel that?
Probably when I had to do that pitch. Because it was so cold that I didn't even have time to get nervous about it. It was like, here's the mic type thing. And you have to just come up with it. And when I saw, as I was doing it, it was like a 30-second thing. As I was doing it, I saw a few people sort of like lean in, like the eyes light up feeling that you get yeah. when you can tell that a story or something that you said connected with someone, and they lean in a little bit. And in that moment, I really did just have this sensation of like, oh, screw it. Like I was feeling nervous or scared or like an imposter, but like it's normal people. Like why not me on all of these things? And that asking that question more regularly in your life, like when you're going out and you want to go do something, you want to start a business, you want to have an incredible outcome, or you want to write a New York Times bestseller, whatever the thing is, it's very easy to say like, you know, why me? Like, why would I be able to do that? I don't have the Harvard degree, or I didn't go to business school, or I didn't do this or that. All these reasons in your mind that you can't do the thing. And every time you ask that, flip it and ask, why not me? Like, someone has to start the big business. Why not me? Someone has to write the bestseller. Like, why can't that be me? What did those people do that was so much better than me?
It's so interesting, though, how we reset all the time. Usually, my sound check question for guests is, what'd you have for breakfast this morning? And everyone giggles because it's such a normal thing. And they're just like, oh, just had cornflakes or I had a coffee.
I get asked that question all the time because people ask me about my routine so often because I talk so much about my fitness.
But that's different for you because like we see your videos and you're like, okay, he's up at this time.
Here's what I eat.
He has hydration. Then he has eggs and beef. We know.
There's no cornflakes for me.
We're invested in it, right? Yeah. But usually when I ask people, they're like, oh, they giggle. And it's just a little, it just releases a valve in them. Because it's interesting, like everyone's nervous. Like you've done probably hundreds of these, so you're not nervous, but a lot of the founders I've spoken to won't have done them. They'll have done incredible things in their life, but they won't have done many podcasts and they're nervous. So anything you can do to kind of like bring that tension down. But it's interesting, like it's like the analogy, there's always a bigger boat. You go to different rooms. Me and my friend talk about this all the time, the next room, moving towards the next room. So for you, you're moving towards the next room in life now, but it's interesting even to hear at your level, there's still that feeling of butterflies and nerves.
Yeah, I think that never goes away. I think we create the impression in our minds that that goes away and that you're going to it's the arrival fallacy, right? You think you're going to have reached some pinnacle where you have arrived and no longer feel that way and you feel great about yourself and the external achievements will have been sufficient such that I no longer feel the internal strife. And that's not reality. That's actually not how biology works. We reset to a baseline. And I think it's healthy to acknowledge and remember that that never goes away along the journey. Some of my most successful friends are my most insecure friends. I mean, frankly, like there have been some major people in the news over the last, you know, 6 months. I'm not going to name names that are probably some of the most successful people in the world that are also some of the most insecure people I've ever seen just based on their actions and the things that I see. Not that I like them or don't like them, but you can just tell it's grounded in insecurity. And it's a healthy recognition to just understand that like you can't solve internal problems with external solutions. And I found that on my own journey. Like I was struggling mightily inside and I hid that from the entire world. And on the outside looking in, you would have said I was winning, everything was great. And internally, there was a whole lot broken and a whole lot wrong and a whole lot that was more to come that was going to break if I didn't change something. But humans are pretty incredible in their ability to put on a mask and hide things. But recognizing that you are always going to feel that sensation of, oh, I don't belong in this room. Why would they invite me? This makes no sense. Like you feel that all the way up the chain. There's maybe five people in the world that are truly high enough that they will not feel that because they are the one. But you're probably not going to be one of those five. And that's okay.
But I think even just to be aware of that, I used to think this all the time, the silver bullet. When I get this, when I do that achievement, when I get there, I'll lose the nerves, I'll lose my anxiety or lack self-confidence. But it's only through reps and putting yourself in those next rooms that you go, huh, I did feel nervous, but it was fine. Everyone's just a normal person. Why do you think so many founders are driven by insecurity and by, I won't say demons, but almost like an addiction? I've spoken to so many founders and they are clearly driven by something to mm-hmm. the detriment of their body and their brain, other parts of their life. Why do you think that is?
It's a little bit of a psychotic behavior to be a founder, especially a founder of a startup or a sort of innovative business, because you have to believe so deeply in something that the entire world tells you is incorrect and false. And you have to believe it so deeply that you're willing to bet your whole life on it. And you're willing to bet years of your whole life on it. You're willing to chew glass and crawl through the mud for years and years when everyone is telling you that you're crazy. And that requires a certain level of irrationality and a certain level of insanity that is admirable when it works out and highly inadvisable when it doesn't. And it's the hilarious thing of entrepreneurship that we judge everything with the benefit of survivorship bias, right? Like we celebrate the entrepreneur who double mortgages their house to go all in on their idea because we know that James Dyson did that and became a massive billionaire in success. But we don't talk about the hundreds of people that did that, that lost their house and lost their family as a result and, you know, had to go live back with their parents. And so I think there is a certain incredibly beautiful struggle that comes with being a founder, especially of these transformative businesses, of doing things differently, that requires a certain delusion in order to be successful. And I see that time and time again in my most successful founder friends that have built big, big businesses. They're crazy. And I'm never going to be crazy like that. It also probably means I'm never going to start a transformative business like that. And I'm okay with that because I've that's not how I define success and not what I want
to
do.
I was just going to say to you, yeah. There's so many levels to this.
Yeah.
And it's the self-awareness piece to go, I would like this for my life.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, I'm quite happy not to go down this crazy road.
Yeah. I mean, I had a realization several years ago that most of the people that I read books about are not people I would want to trade lives with. And that realization has governed a lot of the changes I've made in my life, because what I recognized was that when you read books about successful entrepreneurs through history, business people, we shine a light on one level of the success, which is the financial success, the business success, billions of dollars, fortunes made, all those things. And we very rarely shine a light on the real cost of that success, the lost relationships, the health impact, the time, the mental health struggles, all of the negatives, the cost of entry to achieve that business and financial success that the person achieved. And because of that, most people fail to consider that real cost when they're entering it. So they think that they're getting one thing and what they're actually getting is a completely different thing. And it's the reason why most people have to experience the like big downside of achieving the success to then have the revelation that that's not what it was all about and they changed their life. It's why you see the people up on stage saying like, money didn't buy happiness. And it's like the meme of like the rich person being like, guys, money doesn't buy happiness.
I've seen the other side.
I've seen the other side. Yeah. And it's like, okay, but you made $100 million to figure that out.
Yeah.
And you lost your marriage and you lost your
relationship
with your kids.
Yeah,
you could have made 10 and realized it. But we don't shine enough of a light, so it's invisible to us.
Why?
Because we celebrate as a society, as a culture, what we celebrate is the win. We celebrate the financial side. And no one wants to shine a light on all the negatives and really make it clear. So we
but
celebrate.
Not even the negatives, though. This is why I've changed the entire ethos of my pod. Like, this used to be, well, it's rebranding currently from the Entrepreneur Experiment to the Founder Formula for this exact reason, because I've gone on this journey myself. When I started this podcast, this was a way of figuring out what my next business would be. This was going to be me testing ideas in public. I started interviewing fellow founders and people that I admired. And over COVID, it's evolved into this journey of uncovering these deep unhappiness within founders and seeing that there's more than one way. And having my own realization going, exactly what you said there, most of the people you look up to and are billed as the best entrepreneurs in the world, not in a million years would you mm-hmm. want that life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, multiple failed marriages, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. It's only through my own maturity and kind of experiencing so many deep conversations with people like yourself that I realized going, success is personal.
Yeah, and that's what this book is about. I mean, it is about the fact that if you don't create your own definition of success, you will never feel successful. If you're chasing someone else's, you will never have enough. You'll just be chasing whatever more society or culture tells you to chase. And our default definition of success as society is money. And the big reason is because it is so easily measured. It's very easy to just stick a single number next to your name, and that is your worth. That is how you stack yourself up. That's how you feel. That's how you track your progress. We've never had a way to measure these other things that we know are much more meaningful and actually much more directly linked scientifically and anecdotally to the good life that we all want to live. Time, people, purpose, health. These things that we know create happiness, that create lasting fulfillment and joy. And the funny thing is, you find that the people that ground themselves in their purpose are the ones who make the most money. People that actually are driving towards a life of purpose are the ones that end up having the best financial outcomes. People who just chase money are pretty miserable. Sometimes they make a lot, but oftentimes they're just miserable and they make a good amount. And recognizing that and creating your own set of priorities, creating your own definition of success, and then building your life around that, that's what this is all about.
What was the moment for you that you decided, because there's a lot of founders listening, but also aspiring founders and people who work in companies who are like, I wish I could do what Sahil is doing. What was the moment that you were like, okay, I'm going to take a massive risk? Because were you married at the time?
Married, yeah.
So, you know, responsibilities. What was the moment that you're like, no, I want to give myself this chance?
Yeah, I share it in the book, and I had a profound realization with very simple math that the amount of time I had left with the people that I cared about most was terrifyingly finite. And it was that math that broke me in many ways and made me realize that if I didn't change direction, to paraphrase Lao Tzu, I was going to end up where I was heading. And where I was heading was not good. I mean, I was suffering in a lot of ways. Most importantly, my relationship with my wife was tough at the time because we were struggling to conceive. We were married. We had been trying. And that's a journey that a lot of people don't talk about, and especially men. And that struggle is a burden that a lot of people suffer with in silence. And fortunately, that math of understanding the amount of time we had left and making the change that we did, which was to uproot our entire life. I left my job. We sold our house in California. We moved back across the country to live closer to my parents and her parents, who were getting older. That change was the start of this whole journey to redefine what a wealthy life looked like to us and to build our life around those things. And that change was what ultimately unlocked all of the growth and all of the joys that I feel we've experienced over the last few years. It's just to step off the default path that I feel was handed and create my own.
Mm. Thank you for sharing that, by the way. We had the exact same journey during COVID, 3 years during COVID. Struggled to conceive, had multiple miscarriages, and it's the loneliest place in the world. Thank you. But I think that's why conversations like this, and especially people like you sharing this, is so important, because it's just so lonely. Mm. Like, we were literally physically lonely because we were trapped in our homes.
Same boat, yeah.
And it's just, it's the most traumatic thing in the world, and it changes you for the good or for the better. Thankfully, it changed us for the good. We both are quite strong people, but it changed our relationship fundamentally. It made it so much stronger and so much deeper. And thankfully, Willow is now 2. I know Roman is 2.5. So like, I think it's that synchronicity in your story that just resonates so much with me. Did you know what a successful life looked like, though, when you made that change?
No. I went on a journey. And, you know, in many ways, this book is sort of the end of that journey, in that I get to share this with the world and what I feel I've learned. My name actually means the end of the journey, so it's kind of fitting to share this. In many ways, it's the end of that journey and the start of a new one. But I went out and became a student of the human experience. I mean, I spent time with thousands of people over the last 3 years as part of this book, but also just as part of my own quest for understanding this. I talked to hundreds and hundreds of people and talked to them about what their ideal life looked like when they were older, talked to old people about what advice they'd give to their younger selves. I read all of the, you know, books you could get your hands on, ancient texts, new things, modern wisdom, all of that stuff. And I spent time with some of the most remarkable people who have experienced incredible tragedies, incredible joys. And I learned that the things that we want are remarkably similar across the board and have very little to do with money. And it was those four things I said: time, people, purpose, and health. And money was an enabler to many of those ends, but it was not an end in and of itself. Money is not nothing. It simply can't be the only thing. I'm not here to sit and tell you that money doesn't matter. Financial wealth is one of the five types of wealth that I cover in the book, and is a very important one, especially early in your life to build that foundation. It simply can't be the end in and of itself. It can't be the thing that is the sole focus point. If you are going to focus on it during a season of life, I think that's great. But it can't be the focus across every single season, because you will end up miserable. Guaranteed. Full stop. No one has ever escaped that trap if they've chased it. And the lesson that I really want to hammer home with people is that the chase for more is a distraction, because what it distracts you from is the beauty of enough. And I had experiences along the way that reminded me of that. And it's an experience that everyone needs to get and have at some point, is recognizing that constantly wanting more, constantly chasing whatever more you're told matters, is a recipe for ending up unhappy, unfulfilled, and alone. And what you need to do is pause and reflect on what that version of your enough life looks like. Who are you with? What are you doing? Where are you spending your time? What matters to you? What are you working on? Those things are what are going to contribute to the life that you actually want. And you need to go work towards that.
It's the scariest thing in the world, though, I think. And that's why a lot of people don't do it. Because if you stop and look around, you might like the room you're in.
You might like the room you're in. And the important point there is, it doesn't mean that you tone down your ambition, that you like shut off your professional aspirations, say, oh, I have enough, so I'm not going to do anything. It simply means that those things, any sort of chase, has to be grounded in something other than money. So if I'm going to continue, I have great desire. I want to impact 1 billion people over the course of my life. Crazy. That's super ambitious, insane, right? It makes no sense. But it's grounded in my purpose. It's grounded in the desire to create a positive impact in the world, to create positive ripples in the world. It's not grounded in the fact that I'm trying to make $1 billion.
Yes.
Okay. It's grounded in my purpose.
And this is what I want to dig into with, because – and this is an important point, because I think people either feel you have to be all love and flowers or heartless, ruthless entrepreneur.
No.
Like, I think there is a meeting point in the middle.
No, and if you're,
how do you balance that? Because you seem to have found that balance between your ambition is incredible. Like, what you've done the last 12 months, 24 months following your journey is, like, we were speaking off camera about, like, your last year. I was at an event you did in January 2024, and you said, like, it feels like yesterday, but also a really long time ago. Like, you've crammed so much in. So how do you get that balance?
I think there's a few things I would say. First off, I think it's much more about harmony than balance. I think that balance is a tricky word for people, because what they think is that that means that every single day has to feel balanced. You need equal parts, this, 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 and this. And that's not really what balance is. Balance is much more on a zoomed out perspective. Does my year, does my life feel in harmony?
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
And I think that that's an important distinction, because not every day is going to be balanced. Not every season is going to be balanced. I'm in a very unbalanced season of my life right now, because I'm trying to make sure that this book has the impact that I think it can have on the world. And that means certain things. That means I have to pay the cost of entry. I have to pay the man every single day. And I'm in London for a week away from my young son, away from my wife. I don't want to do that. Like, I would love to just spend every single day with him, but it means something and it matters and I care about it. And so I'm willing to pay that cost of entry to do it. That is what entrepreneurship is. You have to understand what the cost of entry is to achieve the thing that you want. But it has to, again, it has to be grounded in the right reason, in the right thing. I know many entrepreneurs who have made hundreds of millions of dollars, but they're starting another business. Like Mark Lurie is this amazing entrepreneur that I recently had dinner with. He founded diapers.com, made a lot of money, sold it to Amazon. Founded jet.com, made $1 billion selling it to Walmart. Has made way more money than he ever will need. He doesn't have multiple houses. He's got one place. He doesn't have all these fancy, you know, things, cars, whatever. He works. He started a new company and he's building this new thing that's like a really difficult restaurant sort of business that he's trying to build. And you ask him, he's like, this is what I do. This is the best time for me to start a business because now I have all this experience, knowledge, wisdom, networks, and I can work harder than anyone in the world because I've done that my whole life. So now I'm going to work hard and stack that against all that experience. I'm going to win.
His leverage is
I'm going to win. My leverage is sky high. But it's because he cares about it. It's grounded in his purpose of who he is. It's not about making more money because like he knows he doesn't need more money. He wants to keep winning and learning the game.
Is it playing the game? Is it the infinite game?
And he loves the game.
Yeah.
And that to me is really inspiring when I meet people like that, that are so, they understand why they're doing the thing. They're not just blindly chasing, you know, chasing the car like a dog on the street, right? They don't even know what they're going to do. It's like in the movie Batman, the Joker's like, I don't even know what I would do if I actually caught the car. They're not doing that. They know what they're doing and why they're doing it. And I actually think if I were to synthesize it, I've never articulated it this way, but that's really what all of this is about. It's like know what you're doing and why you're doing it, how it actually aligns with the priorities that you really have for your life.
I think you've just hit the nail on the head because I've heard that story so many times and it's part of my transition away from just telling business stories. I'd speak to the founder. What did you feel like? I used to ask the same question. What did it feel like? You know, it's a good one and Sal's got the pen out. I'd say, what did it feel like on the Monday after you sold your company? And this was often for large sums of money, you know, life-changing sums of money, like the amounts you said there. And they'd say, oh, nothing, because, you know, I had a 2-year earnout. I was like, okay, zoom me forward 2 years. What did it feel like the Monday you woke up and you'd no responsibilities, you had all this money in the bank? What did it feel like and what did you do? The honest ones will be like, it felt like nothing. Didn't really change me. The really honest ones will say, I felt depressed. And more often than not, their next phrase, sentence is, I rang around the guys and said, right, what are we starting?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's such a pattern. So we can't ignore it, but I've never heard it articulated just like that.
Yeah. You need to be doing something. Like humans need a purpose, right? It doesn't matter whether you're 90 years old or 20 years old. I have like, in the book, I tell the story of this family friend who I've known my entire life named Hank. And Hank is now 99 years old at the time we're recording this. And he will be 100 actually by the time this comes out and by the time the book comes out. And for his 90th birthday, he asked his wife to spend a day at Harvard going to classes. And my dad, who's a professor there, arranged for him to go and attend these freshman classes. And so Hank, 90-year-old Hank, put on a pair of khakis and a sweater and went and sat in the front row of like an introduction to astronomy course. And he took notes and he asked questions. And it's this beautiful scene, but really what underlies it is this desire for growth and for learning and for pursuing curiosity with no end in sight. There's no utility to him learning about astronomy other than the playing the game, the joy of learning, the joy of growth. His wife is similarly amazing. She's 90 years old now and she's taking new painting classes. She's learning to paint and she gets a lot of joy and life from that. So we have to find at all seasons of our life, whether we're 99 or whether we're 29, you have to find that grounding, that center, what that higher order purpose is. And young people come to me all the time and they ask like, well, how do I find my purpose? I don't know how to find it. You don't really like – it's not something that you just all of a sudden find. You find it through action. You have to do something. Rumi, the ancient poet, said, as you start to walk the way appears. As you start to walk the way appears. The answer is found in the action. It's not planning. You don't create a business plan for your purpose. You don't sit and write out your purpose on a sheet of paper and then hope to go find it. You act and you find and stumble enough until you find your way into it. I spent the first 7 years of my career – with no idea what I wanted to do with my life, working in finance, stumbling around, learning things, meeting great people, whatever. And the invisible opportunity that was in front of me, I had no idea it existed. So when people ask me today, oh, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I have no clue. Because 5 years ago, if you had asked me that question, I would have written out 100 different scenarios for where I was going to be today, and not a single damn one of them would have been right. None of them.
Because I'll be sitting with this Irish guy in a tiny studio in London, and we're doing a podcast, and that'll be my job.
Talking about my book that I just wrote, I had no idea. I didn't even write. There was no writing. And so it's like the most amazing opportunities in your life are inherently nonlinear. They're asymmetric. They're invisible. And they're revealed through action, through doing something in the present. And my honest counsel to someone that's in their 20s or early 30s, if you were going to define your purpose as building a foundation and focus everything you do on that. Because I don't care if you hate your job, if it's you're learning, if you're building networks, if you're doing things, that's building a foundation of knowledge, of networks, of experience, all of those things. Because early in your career, frankly, and this has gotten lost in the narrative about, you know, people love to say like, oh, I'm just trying to work smart. You can't work smart when you're 20 and when you're 30. Like you can't, because the only thing you have in your 20s is time. You don't have knowledge, experience, networks, money. You have none of those things. You have to take your time and trade it to get those things. And that's working hard. Once you have those things, now you can work smart. Now you can deploy those into the right opportunities to create the incredible outcomes. But you can't do that in your 20s because you don't have them. They're not there. You need to actually use your time because that's your only asset, and you trade it for those things.
The dots only make sense looking back. The dots only join
one of
backwards.
My favorites. Yeah.
But it's such a powerful message. And to be honest, it's something I've had to learn and relearn and relearn. Don't overthink. Mm-hmm. Just do. And I think that's a huge lesson for me over the last couple of years, is the beauty is in the action. So I've given myself this formula. It's like, Act 90, Plan 10. Mm. Make your plans. I know you sent out your annual review email today. Do your reviews, do your weekly, but act. Mm-hmm. The beauty is in the action, because there's this fetishization of planning and business plans. And I do this exercise with students, and I got a beautiful email today from a student from 2 years ago going, hey, I just want to reconnect and give you an update. We've just passed this really important landmark. Our product goes live in February. I'm still using the template you gave us. And the template was one page, one paragraph, one line. We're going to work on your business plan. We do it over a day. We're going to work on your business plan for a day, but we're going to cover everything. And it's going to be one page. Then you're going to give it to me in a sentence. And then you're going to give it to me in a line. And by the end of the day, that one line is the most important thing to take out of the room. It's like, if you do nothing today, except get your business down to one line and take action today, they have to have something that they can take action with within a day. 3 hours, 3 days, 3 weeks. Mm. What are you going to do in those three? Like numbers, obviously, and it has to go together. But to get that email from her this morning, especially when I was coming over here to meet you, I was like, there's all these signs if you just look. To get that this morning from her, and it was an incredible product. She had skin cancer. And she developed this, like, it's like a scarf that comes up for people with skin cancer during the treatment because it's incredibly sore. And like, that's something she has built through incredible hard work, passion, but through learned experience and through putting herself out there at that toughest stage of her life. Because I had to literally drag it out of her what the product was. Like, there's beauty in that because she's acting.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. It's beautiful.
Nothing's going to happen in the planning stage. It's important.
Yeah, preparation beats planning. I think about this a lot. Adaptability is a lot more valuable than intelligence. Intelligent people are very prone to the over-planning. I think they need to plan the perfect course. And the reality is that you don't need to plan. You need to prepare. You need to be ready when the inevitable storms and chaos arise.
What's the difference?
I mean, planning is charting an entire course of exactly how you're going to go from point A to point B. Preparation is training yourself for when you start and the stuff starts hitting you and people start punching you in the face and you get knocked back and you go this way. If you just planned and then you get knocked off course, you're like, where do I go from here? This isn't according to my plan. It's like, imagine you're giving a best man speech at a wedding and you have the perfect plan for it and you've rehearsed it and you've memorized it from straight through. And you start your speech and one of the servers drops an entire tray and everything shatters and everyone's like, and laughs, and you suddenly get thrown off and you're 10 seconds into the speech and you completely forget, because that wasn't part of the plan, was for that to happen. Now all of a sudden you're derailed and you just are like stumbling, the whole thing gets screwed up. If you were focused on preparation, you sort of knew different pieces of the speech. You had the Lego blocks that you could put together. You're telling a story. It feels authentic. You're like ready to talk about your best friend, share stories from their life. You know the ethos of what you're trying to get across, that you love them, you're going to make fun of them, the basic building blocks. Now that thing happens and you're able to like take it and spin it into a joke. That reminds me of that time when we do that thing. And all of a sudden people are engaged with it. You were able to create this moment because you prepared. You didn't plan. It wasn't the perfect course. You trusted in your adaptability along the way. And now everyone's laughing and you have a great time. And so it's a reminder that that desire to plan, while natural, especially for intelligent people, because they feel like they want to control the entire thing, steer the ship perfectly, is a fallacy. Because life, Mike Tyson said it best, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And life has a way of punching you in the mouth. And entrepreneurship is basically getting punched in the mouth over and over and over again and learning to come back from it.
So bring me back to your first 6 months on your new journey. What were you doing? You'd moved home. Well, home is where you'd move back to,
the New York area.
So you moved to the New York area.
Yeah.
Bring me back to that time. Bring me back to the first like 3 to 6 months of Sahil going, okay, we're on this new journey.
I had been writing online a bit for the prior, just about 1 year actually, before making that decision. So I had started writing on Twitter when COVID hit, and I had gotten traction doing some of that. Not with any business plan, not with any strategy. There was certainly no intention of ever leaving my job. What are you going to leave a private equity job to be a Twitter writer? Like, it makes no sense.
What were you writing?
I was writing threads on like business and finance mainly, because I was working in finance and I had a lot of knowledge about the space. And so I was creating educational content about that space, breaking down complex topics into simple terms. And
just cause, or what? Why were you doing it?
I had time for the first time in my life. I mean, I was working an 80 to 100-hour week job for many years, and all of a sudden I was stuck at home. I wasn't traveling. You know, I had previously been traveling 3-4 days a week for work. There was no travel because of COVID. I was stuck at home, so I wasn't commuting. So like I just had hours that were given to me, and I could either sit around and watch Netflix and golf, or I could do something. And I'd always really liked writing. And I had a bunch of friends. This is the reality is like, I played baseball my whole life, played in college at Stanford, and I had a bunch of baseball friends who sort of knew me as their finance friend because I worked in finance.
And you fit that little neat box.
Yeah, and it was like it was a time in the world of markets and finance that was very confusing because everyone was unemployed because the world was shut down, but markets were like ripping and going up because the Fed was printing money, in the US at least. And that was very confusing to anyone that wasn't in the world of finance. So I had friends sending me texts asking constantly, like, what about this? What's this? Why is this happening? What's this? You know, there was just like weird stuff happening constantly. And so I would basically like take the questions from people and then spend 8 hours researching something and then write something that simplified it, broke it down. And what I found very quickly was that when you're creating things that are valuable for people, you receive value in return. And I was receiving value in the form of people sharing those things and people following me for more.
And that's the definition of entrepreneurship at its most beautiful form.
Yes.
You create value.
Oh.
And you get value back.
Yeah. And basically, I mean, all that came down to was like identify a problem, which was people didn't have simple understanding of these things that were happening in the world. Identify a solution, which was me researching a bunch and writing about them in simple terms, and then scale that solution, which was me sharing them in a public forum where it could get shared and reach scale. And, you know, by the end of that year, 2020, so in about 7 months, I had grown on Twitter from like 500 followers to maybe 100,000, 75 to 100,000.
That's
somewhere
when
in that
I
range.
Found you first.
Yeah.
I remember seeing you and explode. And I was like, oh, this guy's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I started following you and you were just, you nailed it.
Yeah.
Like you just hit that wave of Twitter.
I was just spending time every single day on it. And like, there's a lot of people that I think have growth hacked their way to certain things. And even now people are like, oh, you growth hacked Threads. I'm like, no, I just wrote for fucking several hundred hours every single, you know.
Everyone
month.
Always thinks it's like, a shortcut, right?
Yeah, like
everyone always thinks, oh, Sahil, I just wrote, had the idea.
Yeah, I was like, oh, I mean, I was the first person who really was like using that long form strategy because I had to, because Twitter didn't have another way to do it. And there wasn't even a function. Like you had to comment under your posts to do it. But I fundamentally, I just wrote 300,000 words on Twitter over the course of 3 years or something. Like I just wrote every single day for 3 years.
Reps.
Yeah. And like, And it was great. Like it was, I still stand by this. Like it was just incredibly high quality content. And so was it a format that was uniquely taking off and was sort of arbitrage? Absolutely. But like I would have just found a different way that was doing the exact same thing. It didn't have to be that. It could have been anything. If like long form essays were working on Twitter, I would have posted them as essays. Like I just would have figured out the way that was working. I wouldn't have just stopped because I went through several periods where it felt like it wasn't really working and I just then found a new way or whatever.
People
it was.
Always think it's that though. They think it's this hack or this thing. People want like, it's the platform. It's this, it's that. No, there's a lot of cope. He's just nailing it.
There's a lot of cope where it's like, oh, well, this didn't, you know, now this wouldn't work. So like, haha, he wouldn't be big now. And like, that's kind of like,
it's the strangest
I wouldn't be big
attitude.
The same way for sure. And maybe it wouldn't be on Twitter. It would be somewhere else. But like fundamentally what I was doing was creating value for people with content that was educational. I can do that anywhere.
But look at your newsletter. Yeah, you've grown like, the newsletter.
Yeah, my newsletter has done it. Instagram has done it. LinkedIn has done it. YouTube is now starting to do it. Like,
doubt me now.
When you create good things, yeah. then you receive good things in return. And so like, and when I don't, when I put things out that I like actually am not that proud of, they don't do well. Like it's not like you just get handed virality or whatever it is. And even like, I've never had a single piece of content that has gotten me over like 10,000 followers. So it's not like I had one thing that just blew up and got me like all of this. It
You're
was
not
just,
the
I showed up
girl.
Every single day. Yeah. No, I showed up every single day. There was never like some one thing. And yeah, so I was doing that and I started leaning into that more. I started my newsletter. That was May of 2021. And that was to explore the concepts that I was writing about on Twitter deeper. The initial launch of the newsletter got 15,000 people to sign up, and I started monetizing that right away. So there was a little business.
How?
Sponsor, like sitting at the top, like a startup I'd been invested in, asked them if they were interested in getting in front of 15,000 people. They said yes. They paid me $500 maybe to do that or something. And so then I was like, ooh. I just made $500 for sending out a newsletter. What if I send two per week instead of one? Now I'm going to make $1,000 a week. I was like, that's 50 grand a year that I just all of a sudden have. And if the newsletter grows, it's going to be more than 50 grand a year. So I was like,
I love that.
Maybe there's a business here. So I started doing it. I started sending two a week. And I was like, man, that's a lot of writing. Because now I'm writing one of the sends was just a Twitter thread that I would put out in the newsletter and like sort of deeper. I would go deeper on it. The other one was like a new piece that I had to write. So I was like, okay, I'm spending real time on this. But it's a real business. There's some revenue now. And there was no team. It was just me, you know, selling the ad slot, I suppose. And so it really started there. And then what I learned very quickly was like, I never considered myself an entrepreneur. I still, as I said, don't. And I just acted. Like I just followed what was happening and saw what I could make of it. And so like I did have a very business oriented mindset because I'd worked in business. I mean, private equity is like you're dealing with businesses, you're investing in businesses. So what I knew was that I didn't want to start playing the game of like doing brand deals. Like all these brands would be like, oh, we'll pay you this much to promote X on Twitter, whatever the thing was. And I would say no, always. And my whole rationale was I want to build businesses that are sort of adjacent to what I'm doing, but not directly tied to it. And so the first thing with that was like, I noticed that a lot of founders that I had invested in were coming to me and saying, can you help us? We want to grow our company's presence or my presence on Twitter, LinkedIn, wherever the thing was. And I had generated a lot of blueprints for doing just that with myself because I knew the type of writing that worked, the type of content, the things, like how to do it. And so I started just like advising a few people, like just as a consultant, basically. And I just thought of it as like an advisor, but really what it was like a content agency effectively. And now I have that language in my head. I didn't have that. It was just me helping a few friends out. But that started generating revenue. And so then I was like, oh, there's businesses that you can build around the things that I'm doing. Maybe I'm going to be okay. So it was interesting. It was just a process of sort of figuring out as I went. There was no, like, I never sat down and planned. I didn't plan on writing a book. Like, I didn't, none of this was predetermined. None of this was grand strategy. It was just like, figure shit out as you go and act every single day.
I love that. I love the raw honesty of that because too many people give you the popping on my rose tinted spectacles here.
I mean,
I'm going to give you,
wait
to hear this, Gary,
yeah.
The origin myth, yeah. Right? And it's like, well, I was sitting on a bus and I just saw this person and I knew I had to change their life. And you're like, no, you didn't.
Yeah, the reality is like every single story you hear like that in a business book is a narrative that is applied ex post to things that happened. And I really try not to do that with my like sort of journey as a, you know, doing these things over the last few years, because it's just not true. Like I had no idea. And if you ask me now, I still have no idea what the next thing is or where it's going. Like, I know the Lego blocks and I'm very clear on the pieces. I'm not clear on how they're going to come together to create something. And that is equal parts exciting and scary. But tolerance for uncertainty is a competitive advantage.
It's a superpower.
And I can tolerate a lot of uncertainty because I know that I have real skills that I can go and create value for people in different ways.
Well, you now have evidence as well.
I have evidence of that. And I can really clearly see it now. Like, I see the Lego blocks so clearly. At the time, the Lego blocks maybe weren't quite as clear, but they were starting to come into vision where I saw, like, okay, this thing that I'm doing has some value to it. Someone paid me $500 for this newsletter. Maybe newsletters are a business. I didn't know that. I never subscribed to a newsletter. I got, like, you know, in finance, I'd have maybe get some emails that I would read every day, but I didn't know about the business of them. I'd never studied that. That wasn't a thing. Creator economy wasn't really a thing. Like, it's just none of this was on the top of my mind. And then what I found was I started getting around people who did think about these things. So I became friends with Austin Reef and Alex Lieberman, who started Morning Brew, and they were like, sold their business for $100 million. I was like, holy shit, newsletters are a business. Like, you can build a huge thing around this. There's an ecosystem. There's like, and then I was in these rooms. I started to get into the next room, as you say. And that next room, I really liked the people that were in it because they were in the trenches on some cool stuff.
You found your people.
Yeah, well, I was like starting to be on a journey where I felt like the things that I was working on were both energizing to me and I was uniquely qualified to do them. I was like, man, I'm really good at this. I wasn't good at investing in finance. Like, I knew probably after 3 or 4 years that the things that – lit up my colleagues who were exceptional at it, lit up the partners, lit up my fellow colleagues at my age, I just didn't care about. I just didn't. And that's fine. Like, it was a good path. It just wasn't my path. And because I was so narrowly focused on money, it was hurting me in a lot of other ways in my life, a lot of other areas. But that is tricky because a lot of people think that being on a bad path is the worst thing in life. And I actually disagree. I think it's much worse to be on a good path that isn't yours. And it's because being on a bad path screams at you every single day to make a change. It's obvious.
Everywhere.
You have
to make
a change. You know, it's a red blaring in your ears. But the good path that isn't yours, there's a lot of reasons to stay. There's a lot of like responsibilities, expectations, status. Like, there's a lot of reasons to stay. And so most people will end up just staying on that path. And they'll wake up in 50 years and wonder what they just did with their lives. And that was me. I just sort of got forced off of it.
It's so bizarre you described it like that, because I rang my wife about 3 months ago and it's after finishing a podcast. I said, you know when you go to the opticians and they put the glasses on you, they make it blurry? I was like, the glasses are on, it's pretty blurry, but getting less blurry. Mm-hmm. I said, I know exactly where we're going and I can't describe it, but I know I'm going to the right place. Mm-hmm. And it was the most freeing and the most enriching moment that I just went, it's okay, because I stopped holding on so tight. I used to be, it has to be like at this many downloads in 3 years and then it has to be this, and it has to be this. And I was holding on way too tight because that's what I'd always done. I'd always planned everything. And then when I just let go of the reins, worked as hard as ever, if not harder, but I just didn't need that certainty anymore. So it's bizarre to hear you describe it in those terms. Just give context, because I'm conscious that if people don't know your story, that was 2021?
Yeah, 2021.
2024. Can you just give some of the numbers? Because some of your numbers across the different things you're doing are truly incredible.
Numbers in what sense?
In terms of your email subscribers, Twitter, social. Yeah. I know it's not a barometer of success, but just to kind of give people context, because I'm conscious if people have never heard your story before, we're kind of having an inside baseball conversation here. Mm-hmm. Just give some kind of flavor of where you are now in 2024.
So Twitter now has grown to a little north of 1 million. Instagram is a little north of 700,000, maybe. LinkedIn is a little north of 600,000. Email subscribers now 800,000 or so. And that $500 per send is now $10,000 per send or so. So it's a great business because it's the same two emails that I send every single week, but you get paid way more for it. Scale is a beautiful thing.
Well, that's the definition of being great at your work. It's the Picasso thing. Yeah. You're not paying me for the sketch. You're paying me for the years of work.
I love that story.
I repeat it all the time.
It's one of my favorites. Yeah, and I'm no Picasso. I'm very far from that. But my email is the thing that I take the most pride in and spend the most time on. Trying to think if there's anything else. And then the book, which I hope will reach a lot of people. You never know. But I really believe that it'll positively impact a lot of people out there.
Well, when you extrapolate out what you've done in the last 3 years, you kind of see the culmination in the book. And when you read it, there's something special about it. And not just in it because you're here. I've been sent a lot of books and most of them aren't very good. It's just, there's something powerful about it. It's so succinct. And I said this to you off camera about the format of like, you're in it. And that might sound silly to people going, of course he's in it. He wrote it. But sometimes you read a book and you're like, the author isn't there. They haven't lived it. They haven't applied. Whereas if you consume any of your content, whether it's on Instagram, Twitter, the book, you're right there. You're putting it into practice. And I think a lot of people know the theory, but you don't learn to drive a car by theory alone. You learn by putting into practice. How did you, so you spent thousands of hours talking to people. How did you transfer that into definitive action? Because something I love about your content is you'll say, I'm going to run a sub-3 marathon. And then you'll document for the next 6 to 9 months, you at every single stage. Was that always how you lived, or is that something new to you?
I have always had a slight OCD streak, probably undiagnosed OCD, in that when I commit to something, I'm just going to do it. And it might drive a lot of people nuts around me and my family or friends, whatever. But I'm going to commit and then go do it. And so the journey with the book was interesting in that the outcome and the product is significantly more emotional and heart forward and storytelling and human experience oriented than I expected it to be. I thought it was going to be a relatively standard business book, business life self-help book. And what it is not that. It has elements of that, and that every section has a guide and real tactics and strategies to help build your life in these ways. But it's also filled with real human stories of people that I sat with, that I listened to, that I heard from, that I became close with, that you will find yourself in. Whether you're a 22-year-old just starting your career, or whether you're an 80-year-old trying to figure out the sunset years of your life, or anywhere in between, you will find yourself in one of the stories about people that I sat with in this book. And that is unique because when you see yourself in something, you actually find yourself and find your way to take action. And that's the impact that I want to have. I have zero desire to give people a dopamine hit from reading something and then they don't go change anything. That's not my definition of success. I really want people to actually take some tiny action to improve their life. And I think the format and the structure and the way the book is set up and the fact that it leans into the humanity of it will lend itself to that.
It's rare. I had a lunch with a good friend of mine yesterday. He's a performance coach and he recommended a book to me. And I was like, oh, I've read it, but it left me cold because it just documented the condition of modern focus. People aren't able to focus in the modern world. I like read it, beautiful writer, but it just left me cold because it just described the chaos that we live in. But there was no, here's what we do. That's why I love the structure you've taken and just the plan that people can go on. It's you said it earlier, and it's weird because I'd written that down on the plane over here, choose your own adventure. It reminds me of those books because you have a section at the end of each chapter where you're like, right, now you do your score and these are the actual steps. Everyone's afraid to actually define it. Mm-hmm. Everyone likes to talk in very loose terms because I think it's people who haven't really done the work. Mm-hmm. They like to say kind of grandiose terms, whereas you boil it down to, okay, if you want a level one, if you want a level two, a level three. In your life, you talked about there about if you say you're going to do it, So obviously we talk about the body, the business and the brain. So bring me over to the body part of your life. You travel an insane amount. You're a dad, you're a husband, you're a son. How do you make that time for yourself? Because that is the number one thing founders say to me, going, oh, you know, I'm just in this stage where I can't have any time for myself. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the worst. It's the saddest thing ever, because they think when they get to 60, suddenly they'll have time and it's too late. It's such a weird philosophy of like, oh, when I'm 60, I'll make time for my health.
Yeah.
The compounding effect is real. How do you always ensure you make time?
Life is filled with laters. And entrepreneurs love later. They say, I'll spend more time with my kids later. I'll focus on my relationship later. I'll spend time on my health later. And the sad thing is that later is just another word for never. You will not, because those things won't exist in the same way later. Your kids won't be 5 years old later. Your wife won't be there for you later if you're not there for her now. Your health won't be there in the same way later if you don't invest in it now. I am a big believer in just daily non-negotiables as a practice. And for health in particular, I find it useful to identify what your non-negotiables are around three core pillars that I talk about in the book: movement, nutrition, and recovery. For movement, I have to move for 30 minutes a day, no matter what. Whether I'm traveling or not, it is a non-negotiable. If I don't have time to go to the gym or go for a run or do any of those things, I'm going to walk for 30 minutes. And it might be that like I have four podcasts back to back during a book launch, but I'm going to walk from one to the other during one of them. There's a 30-minute window, I'm going to walk. And that makes sure that the base is taken care of, the movement. Nutrition, my non-negotiable there is that I eat 200 grams of protein in a day. I'm roughly 185 pounds or so. So it's a little over 1 gram per pound of body weight. And that as a practice, making sure you get sufficient protein, helps everything else nutritionally fall into line. It's a good razor. It cuts through the noise because protein is very good for you. Most of us need more protein, not less. It's very hard to overeat protein. Very few people will actually ever do that. Everyone concerns themselves with it. Very few people actually do it because of the second good fact with it, which is it's highly satiating. It makes you feel full. When you eat that much protein, you eat enough protein, you will not snack on stuff that derails your nutrition and diet because you won't be hungry enough. Like if you're eating 200 plus grams of protein a day, you're not going to be hungry enough as a normal sized human to go eat an entire bag of chips. You're not. And it's going to also make you feel like you're healthier. So you're going to do healthy person things.
And that ripple effect is real.
It's why like AG1 is such a powerful thing. Drinking something green to start the morning, you're probably not going to go eat an ice cream right after that. It's just not, you're going to be like, oh, I'm a healthy person. I just drank that gross green thing. Yeah. I actually think it tastes good. But go drink that green thing and it has a ripple effect.
Yeah.
And then the last one for me is sleep. And my non-negotiable around sleep is that I make every attempt to get 7 hours per night. It doesn't always happen. I'm very good about that, I will say. But
if you were going to tell us the secret of getting a solid 7 hours with a toddler, I think we would have the best, most downloaded podcast.
Yeah, that would be the best.
This year.
Yeah, the secret is go to bed earlier. In all seriousness, people are like, oh, how do you make sure you get that? I'm like, go to bed earlier. People are like, oh, how do you get enough sleep when you wake up at 4:15 every morning, which I do. Like, I go to bed at 8. I get into bed at 7:30.
You're probably the only person that goes to bed at the same time as we do.
Yeah.
We went to bed last night at 7:45.
Yeah, there's nights I get into bed at 6:30 and like watch a show with my wife and fall asleep. I just like, I have nothing to do at that time of night. I'm not productive. It's not useful for me. And I'd much rather wake up early and do something before my son is awake.
Someone rang our doorbell 2 weeks ago at 8 o'clock. And I was like, Michelle, who's ringing our doorbell so late? She goes, Gary, it's 8 p.m.
Yeah. I thought the exact same thing. Okay. Some packages get delivered at 7 or something. I'm already in bed.
It was a package.
Yeah. I get that question all the time. Oh, what's the secret? Because I talk often about waking up early and the benefit on your life.
But you document it though.
Yeah,
you don't just talk about it. You document it every day on your Instagram.
I'm getting the cold plunge at 4:45 in the morning. It's on my Instagram. You can see it. Go out on my freezing ass deck in the New York winter in the snow. But people ask me like, what's the secret to waking up early? Like there's some secret. And I'm like, I'm going to tell you the secret. Lean in. Come here. I'm going to tell you the secret. Go to bed earlier. And they're
give us the real easy. I have a question. How do you not wake your wife?
I set my alarm on very quiet, and it's in another room. I put my alarm in the bathroom, and what I find is that you won't get back into bed if you have to get up to turn off your alarm. So, like, you might hit snooze either accidentally or intentionally if it's right there, but you once you get your feet on the ground, you're not getting back into
bed. So it'll start going off in the bathroom.
Yeah, but very quiet.
But so, is it not like a stampede to get there before wakes up Roman or your wife?
No, I get up quickly enough that I go over and turn it off, and it's quiet. Like, if you weren't aware that it was going to go off psychologically, I don't know that you would, like, wake up from it.
So you're probably wired.
Yeah, there's a subconscious. Okay. If you know your alarm is going off at a certain time, you hear the alarm. It's sort of like in that movie Inception, where the music is the trigger to get to the next dream level. Like, they know the music playing triggers them and they snap. It's sort of like that. I'm assuming there's actual neurology around this, neurological science.
But there's something incredibly powerful.
And often I wake up like 2 minutes before my alarm goes off. I'll just get up and be like, "What time is it?"
Look at my watch. That smug feeling where you're like,
It's good, but it kind of sucks. Like, I love it when you look and it's like two and you're like, oh, I have two more hours. It's the worst when you wake up and you're like, God damn it, I'm tired.
I use my Whoop, the new vibrate setting.
Oh, yeah, that's got to be great.
It's just
that would help me a lot, actually. I could do something like that. Yeah. I don't like
giving my
coding. I don't like sleep tracking.
No?
It stresses me out.
Really?
Yeah, because I know how I feel. I'm so dialed in physically because I've been doing this stuff since I was 16 years old. Yeah. And so, like, I know when I didn't sleep well. I know when I slept well. And I don't want to find out on a day when I feel really good that I slept like shit, because then I'm gonna get in my own head like, oh, I'm tired, I guess.
I don't think you would, though. I think so many people say to me, going, oh, you're always banging on about your Whoop, and I was like, it's a nudge, though. It doesn't drag me to the gym. It doesn't make me eat well. It's just a nudge that I kind of go, I look at it kind of like you talked about earlier, zooming out.
I think the macro would be interesting
over the month, going, there's trends here, and I can see yellow, okay, there's something going on here. Am I eating too late? You know, you can just make macro tweaks, which are really powerful.
Yeah, I can hear that. I can see that.
The brain. Talk to me about the brain.
Talk to me about the brain.
Talk to me about the brain.
In what context?
Because you're quite a self-aware guy, right? You've seen that it's not just about the outputs. It's about the inputs and how you think about things.
Yeah.
So how do you, because sometimes I'll ask founders this question. They're like, I don't want to talk about that. Because they don't want to face up to their feelings, they don't want to face up to their mental health. Mm-hmm. So my kind of definition is, you know, a profitable business, a healthy body, and a fit mind.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you keep your mind fit?
I practice deep curiosity regularly. Engage my curiosity. I mean, I write a newsletter called The Curiosity Chronicle. I try to go down rabbit holes as often as possible. I breathe enough space into my schedule that I'm able to. I very much believe in the idea of creating space in your life as a practice for mental health and for productivity, frankly. Viktor Frankl said that your power is in the space between stimulus and response. That idea I often think about because we live in a world with constant stimulus from everything. And we're told that everything is urgent. So every response has to be urgent. You require a response right away. So there's no space between stimulus and response. The stimulus comes in, you have to respond right away. As much as you can breathe space into your calendar, in that space is your power to choose your response to things, to slow down, to actually see the field, to evaluate, to focus on the things that matter. Creating that space intentionally has been the best practice for me from a brain perspective. And that can be done in simple ways, like adding 5-minute walks between meetings or a 15-minute walk after lunch or in the morning, leaving the phone behind for those. It can be done through a little bit of journaling. I do like 2 to 3 minutes before I go to bed with very simple practice. It can be done with things like cold plunge or sauna or meditation, whatever your spiritual practice, prayer, any of those things are good tools for creating that space. That space allows you to step back and wrestle with bigger questions, like actually think. Because in the modern era, most people don't actually take any time to think. Even when they're sitting on the toilet, they have their phone and they're scrolling it. And the amount of time you spend actually just thinking, and it's no wonder that like your best ideas come when you're in the shower. It's the only time when you don't have your phone on you. There's no stimulus. You're just you and your thoughts.
All man's problems come from the inability to sit in the room on their own with their thoughts.
Yeah. Blaise Pascal, one of my favorites. It's very true. And The world is going to constantly try to take that away from you. And so the creation of that is where you find all the upside. As a general rule of thumb, when everyone is doing and living one way, all of the upside exists in living the opposite way.
Arbitrage.
And so when you see everyone living in a world where they're only always constantly on their phones, you can bet that like the best way to actually generate a better outcome is the opposite. It's doing something different. And I think that the creation of thoughtful amounts of space throughout the day is a good way to do that.
What question are you pondering right now? What are you using your space to think about right now?
One of my favorite questions to ask is, if I were the main character in a movie of my life, what would the audience be screaming at me to do right now? We've all had this experience of going to a movie or watching a television show and like the main character is doing something and
don't
you just want to grab them.
Hey,
don't go in there, like chase the girl to the airport, do the thing. You are that main character in your life story and the audience would be screaming something at you right now. So what is it? Like really sit and think with that.
So what is it for you right now? You're at an interesting stage in your life. What is the audience screaming at you right now?
I think that I have a tendency to fail to give 100% effort because I'm afraid of what will happen if I do and still fail. It's sort of a self-protection mechanism to create an excuse in your mind. And I've always had that. And when it pops up, I really try to shine a light on it so I can fight it because the self-protection becomes a sort of self-rejection in that it becomes a limiter on your growth. You're holding yourself back from your full potential because you're not willing to put your neck out there to fail. And I think that I do that and I need to continue to push back against it when I do.
That surprises me considering having watched your journey over the last couple of years, where could you be doing more?
Everywhere. It's internal, right? Like the external perspective is very disjointed from the internal. Just because it looks like on the surface someone is doing a lot doesn't mean that they're actually doing what they think they could. It's simple too, right? Like, oh, I'm scared that I'm not going to fill this event that I'm hosting. So I'm not going to promote it as much as I could so that when it doesn't fill, I can say, well, I didn't promote it that much anyway. So it's not that people don't like me and people don't care. It's just that I didn't promote it that much. I didn't post about it that much. Or it's like, I'm scared that the book is not going to be the bestseller. And so I'm not going to push it quite as hard. So then I can say, well, I didn't really push it that hard. I kind of just put it out. And I say this to people. I said this to Ali Abdaal and he was like, yeah, I did that with my book. Because I was scared. And you're like, oh, okay. Some of the most people you admire in the world all feel this in some way, shape, or form. Mm. Like, it's ego protection, right? You're like, I don't want to put myself fully out there because that public failure is so scary, especially when you're doing something that is so public.
It's so interesting to see that full circle because I literally had lunch with a friend of Ali's today, Angus, they work together. And I said to him, I was like, Sahil is absolutely smashing this book promotion. Like you're doing like, you're going to go into like book clubs if they buy a certain amount of copies. You're like, if people buy X amount of copies, they can do a Q&A with you. Like it's so much.
I had a turning point on it though, like 4 weeks ago for this exact, I asked myself this question and I called myself out on this, that I was holding back. And so I have changed and now I'm all in. And I'm willing to do disgusting things as a result.
Like you're just like, because I literally said it to him over lunch today going, he is doing everything.
This exact question I wrestled with it, and 4 weeks ago I flipped a switch and was like, if I'm gonna go down, I'm gonna go down swinging. And a part of that is a silly thing that when I signed the book deal, I visited my grandmother shortly thereafter in India, and I told her about the book deal and she was so proud, you know, like Penguin Random House, people know that name. And in India, she was like so proud. And I told her that I was going to write a New York Times bestseller. And that means something like in India, even all
it
around
means
the world.
Something all around the world.
And, she unfortunately will not be around to see. She passed away.
Oh, I'm very sorry. To
but a part of me just feels like, I really want to try to make good on that commitment. And it's stupid. It means nothing. And I know it means nothing, but a part of me is like, I'm at least going to do my damn well best to make good on that commitment, as silly as it is, because it means something to me in some way.
That's what life's all about, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's, create meaning along the way.
It is.
Yeah.
Thank you. That was beautiful to kind of experience that. And thank you for being so open about your most recent thing as well, because I think the external versus the internal, people look at you on social media, and then to actually see the real you here is very, because you share so much on social media, you really get to know you, but then to dig further, it's really, and I think that's part of why there's such a beauty in your content. You are authentic is such a buzzword right now, but like, you are who you are.
Yeah. I don't really know how to be anyone else. just to be honest,
which like, is rare I online
think,
to be
yeah,
fair.
I mean, I think that, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. I'm going to try to create value for people and impact people for the rest of my life. I don't know what format it's going to be in. I don't know if social media will exist. I don't know if newsletters will exist, but I'm going to try to create an impact. I have found my thing that I really love, that I think I can be great at. And I would love to be able to do it in person with people and real and not just on social media. But what that means to me is that I need to be able to do it for a long time, hopefully, knock on wood. And you cannot act, you can't play a role in perpetuity. You can play a role for a year. You can maybe do it for 2 years, maybe 3 years, maybe five. But like, you can't do it for your whole life.
I always think what a horrible life, though, to be trapped within that character. You literally are playing that character all the time. And I've actually seen it happen. I've interviewed some people and I've seen them go green room stage. I'm like,
well, that was bizarre.
Yeah.
You're an absolute miserable
person in the green room. Yeah. I can barely get a word out of you. And then on stage, you're all jazz hands. I was like, bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. I mean, it's, there's ups and downs to it. Like, I think that, you can't always be super on. Like, I'm actually naturally a little bit more introverted, which you would never know when we like have a conversation, we spend time together, when I'm out like doing things like this, because, I can flip a switch and like really, engage deeply. Although frankly, like, if we had 10 people here, you would experience me as much more introverted. Not, I might tell some stories and make some laughs and things like that, but I hate actually group dinners. Like group dinners, I say no to at all costs. One-on-one dinners, absolutely love, because you can actually go deep with someone's conversation. You can really understand someone. But I naturally have a bit of like social anxiety in bigger group settings, I think, that it just means that like I much prefer to put myself in situations where I feel like I can truly be myself rather than trying to like play a role that I need to be. Yeah, and often like if you go into a group dinner, people assume that like, oh, you're, you know, public presence, like you're going to be the life of the thing. And I'm like, I kind of just want to chill and not, you know, even like my family stuff now. When I'm like with my family, I kind of just want to not have to talk. Like I just want to chill and lay low and like go to family stuff and family friends come over and they're like, oh, you know, like expecting you to be the way that you are, on a podcast or on a stage at an event or a thing. And I'm like, that's kind of like my job in some ways. And I want to just like be quiet. I want to just like sit with my son and play with him and like, you know, do the thing. Don't make me tell stories about stuff. This is like downtime. Like I want to just sit with him and hang out and play with his trucks.
I'm the exact same. And for years it tormented me because I was so chronically shy, and it tormented me because it gave me even lower self-confidence because I go into these like areas and I just would just shrink and I couldn't even introduce myself to people. And it was only when I started the podcast 5 years ago that I truly understood what my format was and where I feel alive. Like I would not come up to you in a room of 10 people. I would not be able to have an hour long conversation with you. I would just be there and I'd be like, oh yeah, great. If we were opposite each other, we'd have the best conversation. So it's really interesting that that's quite similar for you. We went to a parents' evening with my daughter like 3 months ago, and I just sat and played with her. And all the parents were up there having adult conversations. And I was playing blocks with her in the corner going, show me your crèche. Show me what you do for breakfast. Show me where you play. And it's funny because people think you have to be one way all the time. Mm. We're just not like that. Humans aren't wired like that. Enterprise Ireland helps to support and fund a vibrant startup ecosystem, providing supports, insights, and network connections to the most ambitious Irish startups. From expert advice to raising funding, exploring opportunities in international markets to strategic planning, Enterprise Ireland is here to support you in those important startup moments. For more information about how Enterprise Ireland can support you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Enterprise Ireland, helping Irish startups go global. You've spoken a little bit about the business side of you. You've kind of loosely referenced, oh, I've invested in this person and this person. So what does your business look like outside of your writing and your newsletter? Like what's your other business interests?
It's set up as a holding company, which has become like a fancy little buzzword that everybody uses. Functionally, all it means is that I sort of have like one company structurally that sits at the top, which is where I sit with my media properties, you know, whether it's the newsletter, the book deal, anything I'm doing, social media, all of that sort of sits on the top as like a halo. And then there's lines to other businesses that I own underneath that company. And I own anywhere from like 30 to 100% of a bunch of businesses that exist underneath it. And then alongside all of that, there is a venture fund that I raise that is a totally separate vehicle because it has outside investors that put money into that. So there's a $10 million venture fund that I raised in 2022 that I invest out of. That's all early stage technology companies, startups. Then there is this holding company, which has five active companies that sit underneath it that are all operated and run by different CEOs that own a big chunk of those businesses and that run them day to day. So I'm not involved in the day to day operations. I help with strategy. I help drive leads to those businesses via my platform. My only actual involvement and my actually own real direct report, if you will, is I have a chief of staff named Blake, who is absolutely amazing, who has been with me for many years. And he is the one that actually manages all the team across all of these different things and is the one that interfaces with all of this. I have a line to him and I focus entirely, almost all my energy on creative work and then on like very strategic, higher level business things and investing things. So that's kind of the structure of it. The holding company structure is nice because it allows me pretty broad ability to reinvest cash flows from the different companies into things that I'm doing. So I can take cash flows from businesses and reinvest it pre-tax into media related things, book launch, you know, whatever it might be. And that's a nice advantage, just structurally being able to do that.
That's really interesting because I was curious how you did so much. It's like, how does he do the fund and the business and all these different companies? So you have a chief staff and beyond that. Because I think that's the bit that a lot of creators fall down on is that they try to be all things to all people.
Yeah. And I don't operate those businesses. Main reason is because I would be bad at that. Like I'm not a great operator of businesses. I've never really run businesses in that way. I don't want to build a team. I don't want to manage people. I don't want to do that. I want to write. I want to create things. I want to share ideas. I want to think about ideas. And so the structure that we've set up really allows me to do that. I can kind of float around and do that. And then everyone else is able to do what they're good at, which is run things. And the CEOs know they have the autonomy to run their businesses. They own big lion's share of those, so they're incentivized to do so. There's a nice harmony around it as a result.
How do you pick your projects? Because we talked loosely about this at the start, you know, your energy and what lights you up. But how do you pick what things to get involved in?
There's not like a perfect process for it. It has been tested through iteration and through screwing things up and picking bad projects where I've learned and then not made the same mistake twice. The biggest thing for me now is that anything that I take on has to have a high probability of being meaningful size. And the definition of meaningful is changing and it's not a perfect number in my mind.
Going to ask you the question.
But I would say, roughly speaking, I have to believe that anything can be over $10 million of revenue or like several million of annual profit. And the big reason is just because I don't have that much headspace. And no matter what anyone tells you, nothing's really passive. So I'm not involved in the operations of these, but they take up little chunks of my mind in whatever way. And I have taken on things in the past that like never had the chance to be that big. And if it's not going to be that big, I should just walk away from it at some point because I'm not going to be a productive member of this team because I'm not going to care about it enough. It's not going to be big enough. And you only get so many swings in life. So I kind of want to take some big swings.
Is that pattern recognition though? Because now you've done your reps, you know what good looks like?
Yes, for sure. and it's only through screwing things up. So to the extent the structure looks clean or the selection looks good or the things I'm working on look good, it's like it's just through messing it up along the way that has improved that selection. I would say general realization, like I much prefer to have a few big bets than a whole bunch of small ones. I used to love and glamorize the idea of like, oh, 25 income streams. Yeah. Now I'm just like, God, that sounds like a headache. I've kind of gone through a radical simplification over the last 6 or 9 months of like pulling back from my involvement in a handful of different businesses and things. And even like, you know, I'm sort of most of the way invested through my venture fund, and the idea of raising another one versus just investing off my own balance sheet, given I have the capital to do so, I might just invest my own money because then I don't have to like send updates to investors. I don't have to like respond to anyone's emails. I'm kind of operating from a place of like I don't want any bosses in anything that I do. I just don't want any bosses. Let's go build things where I don't have a boss. And it's very hard to do, but it's a good razor for cutting through the noise of like, I don't want bosses. So
who do I answer to in this arena?
I would love to work to a place where I no longer take newsletter sponsors. And the only people who sponsor my newsletter are companies I own. Because right now, if one of the newsletter sponsors is unhappy with the ROI that they got, I'm getting an email being like, well, you know, the copy wasn't that good, whatever. And like, I don't care. I want to get to the point where like I can just detach from that and say, I don't need your money. So I'm just going to do it with one of my companies.
Before we move to our quick fire round,
yes,
a couple of listeners sent in questions. One of them actually we touched on earlier. Sahil leveraged Twitter to grow. What is the Twitter thread of 2025?
On Twitter, I think that visual stuff is the way that everything's headed. They've kind of TikTokified the algorithm, so your followers don't really see your posts. It's algorithm based, and visual stuff is being pushed harder because that drives ad monetization. So I think that video and images will be a big part of whatever works in the future. I continue to think that like education is the way to actually grow meaningful followers. You might be able to grow followers with just memes or whatever, but those aren't valuable followers because they don't know who you are. They followed you for memes.
There you go, Stephen. He said memes. He goes, P.S. The answer is memes.
I'm Stephen, no, I think memes is a great way to grow followers, but not quality.
Outside of Twitter, what are you looking at in 2025? What's kind of – where are you putting your focus?
I love LinkedIn. I think there's a lot of value in LinkedIn. I'm spending a lot of time and will – really be spending a lot of time on YouTube in 2025. It's very difficult. And it's a platform I don't understand.
I really enjoy them.
But it's fun. And I'm trying to find the way to do it that's fun. Not the way that's like optimized for growth necessarily, but the way I enjoy.
Yeah.
And so
I think that's how you win in the long term.
I think so too.
Because I follow people that I enjoy that are authentic. I don't follow like 10 things you know about like your hydration. I'm like, ugh.
And I'd rather have like 75,000 people that like – it's their diet. They're watching like 20 minutes of a vlog I put up than like 250,000 people that are like came to me for some clickbait headline that I did. So that's just true. And I'm able to say that because I have other things going on. But yeah, I'll be spending more time on that.
Yeah, I'm bullish on kind of longer form as well.
And then the other thing I'm really bullish on is just in person, like real in life communities and experiences. And so I'm going to be creating more of those, bringing people together.
The YouTube videos on your masterminds are one of my favorites.
Yeah. Yeah. I love those experiences. I want to do more of those for more people to get access to. So I'm going to do more stuff like that.
You need to bring it to Europe, man.
Yeah, I would love to.
Let's Marbella 2025. Yeah. Let's do it.
I just was with Rob Lipsett, who's in he's a great guy. He's in Marbella,
Yeah, I was down with him in the summer.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
He's such energy.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
I love Rob. He's just all positivity. Really, really successful guy. What experiments are you running or did you run recently?
Experiments. We run tons of experiments on different things with book marketing. Life experiments, I don't know. I kind of have found things that really work for me in my life, so my routines haven't changed really at all. I guess I physically I'm like I ratcheted way down my mileage on my running during this off season to focus more on growing and muscle growth, and that's been a lot of fun for me, making a change there. But other than that, I'm sort of in a season of doubling down on things that I know work.
Nice. Dara has a really good question for you. Which of the five areas in your book do you rank the weakest on, and what's your plan to improve them?
I would say right now I am probably the weakest on time. And I'm very much in a season of unbalance, as I said. I'm really strapped. I'm really leaning into this thing. And the plan is the recognition that this is a season and that I need to lean into it, but that I need to have the awareness that the pullback needs to happen. And so for me, that means that I need to really make commitments to certain things for, you know, the book launches in February. So really like for summer and fall to make sure that my family and I truly have downtime. I was with Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, and he takes 6 weeks off every summer, like completely off, turns off his phone. There's no technology, nothing. He travels with his family, and I don't think I can do that yet, but can I do a week where I do that and really set myself up for it? I think that's going to be my goal for this summer as a way to just reclaim that.
Your reading week, like the Bill Gates reading
week.
Quick fire round. What book do you recommend every founder should read?
When Breath Becomes Air.
What's something you've learned the hard way?
That money doesn't equate to a good life.
What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
Friendships, time, mental health at different times, physical health at different times, basically everything.
What would you do today if I give you $10 million?
What would I do? Nothing. I don't know. I'd invest it in trying to get the book out, I guess. I'd put $10 million behind an ad to try to sell more books.
Yeah, it's not a trick question.
Wouldn't change my life.
I'll revelate you. I'll cash up you $10 million and you can do whatever you want.
So yeah, I think I'd just put it behind a bunch of ads to try to get more books in more hands of people.
Make it that MIT bestseller.
Yeah, and just like increase the odds that it becomes a massive movement.
That's my favorite answer. Me and my wife play the lotto game. It's like, what would you do if you won the lotto and do more of what we're doing now?
Yeah.
That's the kind of millionaire moment, right? Yeah. I'm going to give you $1 million. You can only invest in one person or one company. Who is it?
Myself and my company. Can I answer that?
No, you can't. You already took the $10 million. So give me someone else. You've got $10 million. Now we got one. We're going to give it to someone else.
There's a kid named Dominic Schluter who started this podcast when he was 16 called The Running Effect, which is like a sort of niche running podcast, and has like just by the, you know, his own grit built this thing and has all the best guests and is getting all these things going. And he's just starting to scratch the surface on it being a business. And I think I would give it to him and figure out how to build like a big running media company around it.
I could see that.
Yeah.
If you were starting again right now, what would you do?
Probably the same thing I'm doing right now, which is create content that helps people.
What do you believe that other people will find weird or strongly disagree with?
That the fastest way to change your life is to wake up for 30 days at 5 a.m. and work out.
That was the first tweet I sent last year after your event. Mm-hmm. Point number one, no loser wakes up at 5 a.m. and works out. I laughed at that this morning. I was reading it back on the flight this morning.
I was like,
can't argue with that one. That's one of those just things that
I stand by that
is
too.
True. What's been your worst investment?
Oh, anything that I tried to do short term, like tried to make money quickly. Any NFT, any crypto thing, any stock that I tried to trade, I've lost money on every single time. I've never made money on like a short term investment. I mean that very seriously. I don't think I've ever made money on a short term investment.
Just like buy Bitcoin and hold.
Yeah, anything that I bought and hold, I've made a lot of money on, including myself. Anything short term, I lose money.
What's been your best investment?
I mean, the cliche answer, myself. The not so cliche answer. I've done very well on a few pieces of real estate that we lived in. And the Main reason is because I didn't view it as an investment. I viewed it as a beautiful place to live that we were very happy to live in for the rest of our lives if we needed to. And sometimes when you do things like that with the right long-term intentions, I feel like they turn out the best. I think on a technical return sense, Bitcoin has been my best investment, but that's kind of boring to say. It's like, and I'm like, I'm not like a Bitcoin guy. It's just, yeah.
I'm not. I have it. I like it.
And like, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway. Yes.
What's your final piece of advice for every founder or aspiring founder listening?
Final.
Just
define the things that matter to you, not blindly accept the things that people tell you matter, what you're supposed to focus on. Really sit with the question of figuring out what matters to you and then go build your life around it.
Finally, tell us about the book. When is it out?
February 4th, so I assume it's out right now.
Day after my birthday.
Right, there you go.
Almost perfect launch date.
Yeah, so it's out, available everywhere books are sold, all over the world, and you can find more information at thefivetypesofwealth.com.
And then in terms of you, you're on every single platform. Where can people find you?
Yeah, Sahil Bloom, anywhere basically. Weird name, so it's easy to find me.
Sahil, that was an absolute pleasure. That's Thank you awesome. So much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.